Okay, so I will be describing the work done in Florence, combining ultra-cold atoms, bosons B, C, and fermions with optical lattices. The work that we'll be describing is coming essentially from two different experimental groups. One is working essentially with the rubidium BC. This is the original one, and the other part of the talk will come from the experiment where we mix Fermi and Bose gases, and so we report also on comparison between bosons and fermions. Here, the key people are Chiara Fort for the first apparatus and Giovanni Modugno for the second one. So the outline of this presentation is essentially that I will discuss briefly and quickly the transport of a BC in an optical lattice, essentially to give some words on final words on some instability that we already observed in the past, and now I think we have clarified the situation. Then I will discuss the transport properties of fermions and bosons in optical lattices. And then I want to devote the last part of the talk to the atomic interferometry that now we are developing with the Fermi gas. So let's start with the BC in optical lattice. So already a few talks before this one during this conference have shown the importance of putting the BC in an optical lattice, so in a periodical potential. And I simply want to say that the work done in Florence during the last years has been concentrated essentially on the coherence that you can create between ABC in one side and the next one and the next one and the next one and so on. And essentially, if we play when we place it. This optical lattice horizontally on a rubidium BC in the expansion we could observe this diffraction pattern, and we considered that these peaks there were the evidence of the coherence between each side and the next one, and all this was observed and understood in interaction with the group of Sandor Zingari in Trento as for the theory. Now, if there is this phase lock between the n and n plus and n plus one, this also means that if we give a kick exactly like yesterday Porto from Nice has shown, I mean, we simply moved the magnetic field of our harmonic trap, and we give a kick, and then we can observe the essentially still the condensate going up and down, up and down, up and down, almost without damping, simply changing the frequency of the oscillation. And this behavior could be nicely interpreted as essentially is a picture of an array of a Josephson junction. And indeed, from the theory, we could report the frequency of oscillation as a function of the intensity of the optical lattice, and everything was working properly. And so this condensate goes up and down, up and down, up and down, without damping. This is true until we don't move this condensate a bit more apart. I mean, if we have oscillations which are small. In fact, when we increase the displacement, so essentially instead of starting from a position close to the center of the trap where still we have the oscillation, we move the condensate much more, 100 microns you see here in the scale of our experiment, then you see we have no longer oscillation, but we have just a slowly damping of the condensate towards the center of the trap. Also, it's interesting to see that when we do have the oscillations, also, we still have the two peaks, which are evidencing, the coherence between one side and the next one. While instead, when we have no oscillation, we are in this situation, eventually, this interference pattern, you know, disappear. And so this is what we call the disruption of the superfluidic current in this dynamics. Okay. However, there was a suggestion in this paper by Augusto Smersi and others that what we had observed was simply again a manifestation of a dynamical instability, which is typical of all nonlinear systems. And similar work has been done also by Wu and Yu and by my chairman today on this topic. And so here the idea is that putting this condensate with repulsive interaction in a periodical potential, then in the solution of the problem, then one has a solution with imaginary solution, and then even a small perturbation can start a strongly dynamic instability. In order to understand this, we decided to do a cleaner experiment. Instead of moving the cloud, the condensate apart in this potential, we decided to keep the condensate in the bottom of the potential, and instead to move the optical lattice. And then the experiment is done as follows. So we load adiabatically the condensate in this optical lattice. So essentially, the condensate goes to the lowest band of our periodical potential. Also, we can fix the quasi momentum in which we load our condensate. And then we wait for a while before releasing everything and seeing how many atoms are still in condensate. So essentially, we do many measurements like this. We measure the number of atoms as a function of the time of staying in this harmonic plus optical trap, and then eventually we can record curves like this. We can essentially measure the loss rate as a function of the quasi-momentum. And then you see that almost nothing happens until we are still around the middle of our band. But then suddenly, when we approach a value of 0.5, 0.6, then suddenly it starts a big loss rate in our experiment. And here I want to point out that really we have orders of magnitude in change of this lifetime. We go from lifetime which are of the order of seconds to only milliseconds. Also, another interesting feature which happened is that when we are here in this situation where the situation is stable, then the condensate you see is still uniform, without any phase disruption or things like this. When instead we are in the unstable part, then you see that on the time scale of only 50 milliseconds, we start to see all these structures. This is a sort of a fragmentation of the phase that we do observe. So we can interpret this as dynamical instability also because solving the equation that I showed you before, this was done by Michele Modugno, that the theorist that we have in the group, then we can essentially compare the losses versus the onset of this instability. And you see that the experimental behavior nicely follows the theoretical prediction in the first, second, and even third band. So now we do think that we have observed this dynamical instability of a condensate moving in an optical lattice, and still there are things not fully understood. For instance, what we observe that we can again restore this uniformity. I mean, we have.
What is the signature of a higher band in this growth?
Pardon?
What is the signature of a higher occupation, a higher band in this growth? Is it possible to identify?
Because we can. What do you mean the signature? I mean, we.
You in the previous figures, you see that there's a. You say you can understand the growth of in the lower band and also in the.
Yes, it's because we can change the quasi momentum by which we. We put on the.
No, it's one thing. The picture,
sorry. Oh, sorry. This one. So this is up to here. This is the first band, and this is the second, third, and then so on. And we can load the condensate directly in. I mean, with this quasi momentum, and so we are in that band. Okay.
Yeah, possible. So the Q band is not just with the speed at which your lattice moves, but also the effective mass, or is that Q constructed from the speed
room
of the lattice and the
barrels? No. With okay, the effective mass change. I mean, in this problem, but we simply what we do, we simply manipulate what you would like, what you would call the momentum. I mean, mv lattice, and then loading the condensate that
m not m star. That's
m
x-axis
m.
mv lattice.
Okay. Now,
how do you measure the loss of electrons? What is
the loss? Okay, we measure the we know how many atoms we have. I mean, we have before. Then we leave the condensate interact with the optical lattice for a while, and then depending on the time that we have there staying the condensate. Then after that, we measure the number of atoms, and so we simply the atoms remaining. And so, as I want to tell you, if then we have observed, you know, that this spreading of the phase into many, you know, sub-states, then if we simply turn off now the optical lattice and we simply leave the condensate in the magnetic trap, then the uniformity is again restored. What I want to say, going back to this picture. Hello?
I just wanted to ask, how does the size of those fringes appear compared to what you expect the size of gap solitons to be?
Okay, you want already to enter the interpretation of these things. So, okay, if you can see that I am already answering like I was saying. I mean, any interpretation of this, and actually during this day I was also discussing with Augustus Merz, is that probably we are. Could be that we are creating solitons, and it turns out, and then when we see this story, the restoration of a sort of uniformity, simply we have this evolution of a soliton. This could be an explanation.
At least, what is the size of these pictures?
Pardon?
What is the scale of these pictures? Are these time of flight pictures?
This is time of flight. We time of flight after I think they're 80 milliseconds or something like that of expansion. Just a quick information that we were even able to measure the losses here, I mean, in this region where there is not the dynamical instability, and we did this leaving using either a pure condensate with a strong RF cut, but also instead with a condensate with some residual thermal cloud in order to allow the system to have a dissipation and so to study the energetic instability, which we were able to demonstrate is occurring not at 0.5, but much before, 0.3, almost following the predictions, and also with a time scale which is totally different. There we were talking of milliseconds, while instead the typical lifetime of this energetic instability is of the order of 400 millisecond, alpha second, or so. This is what I wanted to tell about the system, and then I want to switch to the experiment where we can use either ultracold or condensed bosons or fermions. Okay, in Florence we produce the general Fermi gas of potassium by sympathetic cooling with rubidium. It's essentially in the very same apparatus we can play with both the species under the same external conditions. And I will quickly show you the effect of the dynamics in this horizontal optical lattice of spin polarized fermions, where there are no collisions, of course, and then the mixtures, where essentially I can add the collisions. So when I go with the identical fermions, and then here is the behavior in the actual space of this sloshing up and down, at least when I am the parabolic part of the band, I see essentially that after a while I have a regular oscillation up and down, simply because maybe the fermions which are starting a little bit farther, where they are changing the amplitude, that after a while they enter the overall oscillation, and it's nicely to see that the block picture enters a little bit the description of this phenomenon. So when we announced the dynamics of the BC to an optical periodical potential using the description of the Josephson effect, Still, there were discussion whether, after all these physics could be described by a single particle physics. I mean, not really. Okay, there are phenomena which are related to the fact that it's a BC. We saw collective excitation. I mean, many different things. But you see, with the fermions, we can nicely reproduce simply using the block, curve, essentially related to the change of the effective mass that we are producing. The same picture that I already showed you for the Josephson effect. Then we try to do the same with the bosons, and I wanted to show you the same quality of the transport that I've shown you before with the fermions, but now using rubidium instead of potassium. And you see that here we have instead a damping on the oscillation of the bosons. And this damping is much larger than the one that we eventually observe also with the fermions when we go at higher intensity of the optical lattice. So essentially, rubidium boson, the bosons, they damp much faster than the fermions. And so what we think is that this collision can assist the defacing mechanism. And just to check, and these results is pretty similar, even though the system is totally different, to what observed the NIST with these tubes. And so I'm wondering whether what exactly are these tubes? I mean, whether they are still condensate or phase, and so on. So would be interesting to compare this, these things. Just to evidence that the importance of the role played by the collisions, now I repeat here the experiment done with the fermions. So the fermions, they go up and down, up and down, up and down. In this case, S is not even one, so really the experiment is nice. But instead of having identical fermions, now we add a little bit of fermions, half of the fermions in the other spin state of potassium, and now again you see that this fermions now is damped, extra damped, like it happens on in the case of the boson where there are the collisions, and this could mean that this dynamics in an optical lattice could be also a tool to test the superfluidity. Provided that recently Sandro Stringari and also they have demonstrated that in the hydrodynamic regime, the situation of a strong interaction, still there should be a damping. And so only in the case of a superfluidity, then one could again have a non-damped oscillation of a Fermi system. But let now me go back, because I want to introduce the last part of the talk, the story of these fermions, which are side of our parabolic curve. So again, I'm no longer here with a small displacement, but with a large displacement. And then another interesting effect that we observed of the collisions is that when there are no collisions, essentially the fermion should have this block oscillations. They should be localized, I mean, aside, without any transport to the center. And this is exactly what we observe. We have a pure Fermi gas sample, largely displayed, and simply after a few oscillations, but still stay there, that doesn't go down. Well, instead, when we add the bosons, so we allow the fermions to interact each other, then we can have a transport which is collisionally induced by the collisions. And then I don't come from the field of solid state, and then eventually I understood that really transport in solid state, I mean the current, is just possible because there are impurities, phonons, or otherwise I should have this block oscillation there trapped without any kind of transport. So having this in mind, and especially having been talking, thank you, with the friends from solid state physics, and I was told that the word block oscillation was not really proper in this case, because a block oscillation is exactly when you have a constant force. So the ideal case was simply to place this atom gas in a vertical scheme. This is optical lattice. This is the experimental scheme of which Mark Kasevich has also talked a couple of days ago, giving all a description in terms of, again, macroscopic with a BC, of a phase and with different phase evolution at different altitudes, because there is a different gravitational energy, I mean, and so on. But now, having in mind the story of the block oscillation, we should expect essentially again a single particle behavior without, not related to something, you know, macroscopic, I mean not really proper of the BC. And so to give you simply a description of this cloud going down and then back reflected, every time they reach the, every time they reach the end of the brilliant zone. Essentially giving simply the semi-classical picture with the block oscillation, I expect a frequency of oscillation which is related to the force that now I am applying, mg, because now I am in a vertical optical lattice, times the spacing, which is half of the wavelength that by which I'm producing my optical lattice. And so I should have this block oscillation up and down. And whenever I reach the end of the band, I should simply see if the optical lattice is not strong enough, a Lanzhou-Zener tunneling, I mean, out. And this is exactly what we observe with the BC, practically repeating the original experiment of Mark Kasevich. Practically interpreting, we now interpret this as a block oscillation, which for the cold atoms were originally already observed in, not with the BC, with the cold atoms in Paris, and then we decide to go ahead. So to do the same experiment with higher and higher temperature, and even with really a thermal sample, and again we see some residual of interference. I mean, so it's really it seems to be a single particle, I mean, physics, and not really we really don't need a macroscopic, you know, wave function. But then we said, well, let's try this with the fermions, because if it is a single particle, it should work also with the fermions. And in fact, we see the interference also with the fermions, even though not so nice as with the BC. But very important, before releasing this cloud to see this interference, or what Mark calls interference, we kept the system trapped for a while in this in this trap, and then we see that. So we increase the optical lattice. We keep it trapped for a while in a very high intensity, and then we go down, and then we do again the picture, and you see that still we see the interference. So essentially, this Fermi gas, when it is trapped in this tight optical lattice, they are not perturbed. I mean, so in our interpretation, the block oscillation are not destroyed. If we repeat the same experiment again with the BC. So we again, of course, see with zero trapping time, we see the interference. But then when we only trap for 2 milliseconds in the tight optical potential, then we see the destroyment of this interference. As an evidence that now the BC, something is happening with collision or mean field, decoherence, and so on. But the other, I think, interesting thing that was done, that we did, was the following, that instead of releasing in a fast way the optical clouds, sorry, the atomic cloud from this optical lattice, we decided to use an adiabatic decreasing of the intensity of the light in such a way that we could map essentially the momentum state of this system, essentially to directly observe the block oscillations, and not only the interference after the release. And this is exactly what we could see. You see, this is the cloud of Fermi gas here going down and reaching the edge of the brilliant zone, and then going back and starting again and starting again and starting again. So this is interesting now, because these oscillations that we can record for 100 or 150, of these oscillations, because they are not destroyed, because these are fermions, so they are not destroyed. Essentially, we have been able to transform the measurement of a physical quantity like a force, in our case this is the gravitational force, into a periodically oscillating signal, so we can extract the period of oscillation. This period is related to the force, and then of course the H constant enter, and then from here we can extract the force, which in the gravity, in our case, and so far at the level of 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5, because this was just done as a quick experiment. And so you see that the absence of collisions all over this long lifetime of block oscillations. But then we decide to go back to the BC, because when Eric and Capri announced the BC in 9 years ago, I remember that many of us who were there, we say, well, now atom optics, interferometry, atomic interferometry, and so on, will face the same revolution which was opened by the laser introduction in the regular optics, because BC is an atom laser. The problem is that these bosons, they interact, and you see now the picture of the block oscillation, when they are of equal, the two peaks are, equal. And you see that in the case of the fermions, we can follow up to essentially 100, in this case, oscillation, and still we can see some oscillation. While instead, in the case of the BC, this is practically immediately destroyed. After 2 or 3 of this oscillation, this is destroyed. So this is a decoherence, effect, which could be related to the modulation instability that I showed you before, because during this oscillation you pass through the quasi-momentum, which create a little bit of instability, and so on. So the things are related. However, this is, I think, so this evidence that with the fermions you can do interferometry with a possible, very high accuracy, originated by the absence of collisions, I think is the other phase of the medal, where the other phase is what the group of Wolfgang Ketteler has observed at MIT, which is the absence of the clock shifts when you use an atomic transition to see a clock. Also in that case, the effect is that you have no effective collision in shifting something. And so, just to conclude this last part of the talk, essentially this means that now, using a fermionic species, we have created an interferometer with a rather high spatial resolution. It depends on the extension of the wave function of an atom to the lattice. In our case now it's of the order of a few microns, but could be also changed. Here, at the present, we have the level of 10 to minus 4, but we expect that could be easily go to 10 to minus 7 or so, because for reasons here, simply even light is not stabilized. I mean, the mirrors, I mean, and so on. And essentially, the limits here of the accuracy in principle should be the ratio of H over M, which is at the level of 10 to minus 8, or maybe a little bit better. But possible application of this are forces at a small distance, because we have this special resolution. And of course, before going to gravity or things like this, it would be interesting to study typical forces close to surfaces, Casimir. But of course, if one wants to get money from a special agency and rich agency, one can say that if you report here the short distance scale where you want to do a gravity measurement, and here the limit, I mean, for Terry, no, is not true. I mean, the gravity is still 1 over F squared. An extension of our experiment at 11 to 10 to minus 7 would allow us just to enter, you know, an interesting region. I think now it's time to conclude. So this is the group that I have very lucky to have in Florence. This was taken 2 weeks ago, I think, in the occasion of the last thesis that we have discussed by Luigi De Sarlo on this modulation instability. So I was telling you before, this is Giovanni Modugno, the key responsible for the experiment with the fermions. This is Chiara. Pardon?
The boss.
Will be a boss. And Chiara Fort, the one for the BC, and then other are PhD students and guests, and so on. So I try to recover a little bit of time. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you very much for a very nice talk.
Massimo, you showed this convincing data on the dynamical instability with a sudden onset of the damping, which I think is really quite important when you reach pi over 2 phase shift, when the negative, where the effective mass cross is negative, the first part of your talk. Can you comment on the role? I mean, this is strictly known to be true, this dynamical instability in a 1D situation. I mean, can you comment on the role of radial excitations in your case? What is expected about the sharpness of this onset of this dynamical instability in this case?
The radial excitation, I didn't
pull off. If you're radial, you're not in a 1D situation. I mean, you have radial degrees of freedom. In your case, what is known about how this affects the sharpness of this
transition? Okay, I thank you for these questions. When also Porto yesterday was talking of this pancake situation, which one would imagine that we are in a sort of a slit of planes of. Of light and then of atoms, and so on. So essentially 1D problem. Mm-hmm. Instead, as Emmanuel is pointing, this is not a 1D problem. This is a little bit a 3D problem, because there is also some radial confinements. And the introduction of the 3D, the three dimension essentially in the theory, was the one who really was able to allow us to fully understand, the behavior. Mm-hmm. Essentially, when we lose, we have some oscillation, some damping of the modes that we observe. What we observe, and then eventually these things are recovered, and then you can see this in the 3D, simulation, because the role of the other dimension, the radial, is that some energy is released to these radial modes and then goes back into the experiment. So it's fundamental to put this in the description.
If I can just ask a follow-up, you had some beautiful experiments earlier on superfluid effects on measuring the critical velocity, just the same way having the condensate oscillate through the lattice and looking for okay, interference patterns go away, or heating, or heating in the system, which were done at similar lattice depths, if I remember, or slightly lower. At that time, it was interpreted as critical velocity.
Yes.
Can you comment what is the what is the role
I thank
now?
You, I thank you very much for for this question. So this experiment now is in particular clarified a long debate that we had on our original experiment of 3 years ago, Burger et al., where we were interpreting this disruption of a superfluidity with a, you know, the critical velocity mean and so on. Now, and actually Marie-Lou was also in that paper. What now we really think is that also that experiment essentially was simply the dynamical instability. But since it was, if you remember the figure, now I have not here the figure, there was not this sharp behavior, it was a sort of a smooth, evolution. And this was because when you do this experiment simply moving the magnetic trap, then you have a non-homogeneous, you know, system. So the different critical, value for the things, they are different from one side to the other. But you are perfectly right.
Could I ask you about the picture you showed of the difference between the fermions and the bosons, about the fermions getting trapped due to the Bloch oscillations and their position being stuck, whereas the bosons could relax further into the trap?
Yeah.
Did the distance that the bosons got further down into the trap, did that depend on the number of bosons in the cloud?
It depends on the number?
Of the bosons.
Oh yes. Yes.
So if you have more bosons, it gets further down that curve.
Yeah. I if you want, if I don't make anything dramatic, and I open, I think this stuff. Maybe. However, we did study the dependence on the number. Okay. Let's show. No, it's not. Okay, it's not here. I thought it was there. However, we have done a systematic investigation of this transport as a function of the number of bosons, which means it's a control of the collisions. And what is fun, at least surprising for me, is that the behavior, it shows that when we add the bosons, we first increase the, you know, the mobility, then we reach a minimum, and then we go back to, so there is some critical situation. And the funny thing is that to fit this curve, which I repeat, simply this fermionic behavior through these bosons, which are only used to create the impurities, we use exactly the formula that Ezaki used for the transport of electrons in, in a crystal. So it seems to work. But
can I ask one other quick question? Did you try it with both spin states for the fermions as well as one spin state?
No, with both. What you mean? To instead of using the boson to add a little bit of but we have not really done that in a systematic way. That was a sort of a quick experiment, simply adding.
Depending on the sign of interactions, you might get different effects.
Well, but in which sense will be different from simply add the collision via the bosons? I mean, do you expect some qualitatively different?
I think if you had two species that attracted or repelled, you might reflect the results.
Okay. Maybe we can discuss further.
Sure.
Ignacio, could I see the screen, the plot of the atom loss rate, versus growth? The atom loss rate.
Yes.
Can I see it?
Growth rate. Okay.
Yeah. Could I see it on the projector?
Yes. Okay, Santa Barbara. I think
yeah, it's below.
Where is it?
Yeah, the one below, that one, yeah.
Or this one?
No, the next one. No, you already had it.
Okay, wait a moment.
That one, okay. Anyway, these are very interesting results, but I just want to, the way I understand it is that there obviously is some correlation between experiment and theory, as your results show. Yeah. But one result, which is growth rate,
But what I wanted to...
Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, maybe I'll just ask my question anyway.
Finish with your comment.
Okay, the growth rate you've got, and then you also measure the loss rate, these two measurements. Or I should say experiment and theory, but as far as I can see, the details of how you go from one to another must be complicated, because since the theory is based in Gross-Pediewski,
exactly,
the total number of atoms can't change, right? So you would have to introduce some sort of collision transfer between the thermal cloud and
okay,
yeah,
that's I fully agree with your comment, and in fact, what we write, in the paper, we say that this is to show that there is a correlation to the fact that when the theory, which is done with the Gross-Pitayevsky, and which only studied the beginning when we are still linear, then the nonlinear phenomena happen. So, but the beginning of the growth of these instabilities is qualitatively reproduced in the fact that we do observe the this destroyment, if you want, of the condensate, of losses or whatever. And this was, which was convincing.
I understand.
Yeah,
yeah. There is an improved theory.
There is a lot work that you could do.
Precisely the theory that one uses.
Yeah.
We heard about in the earlier talk.
Yeah.
About growth rates.
Okay.
You have to have a mechanism, what we call C12, between the thermal gas and the condensate.
Yeah.
And I think this comparison between experiment and this improved theory might be more quantitative.
I must say that less qualitatively, I don't know whether more quantitative comparison now is being made by Franco Dalfovo and Michele Modugno, who are modeling everything, but still they are with the Gross-Pitayevsky, so they are just observing the beginning, and you are welcome to think about, and I'm glad,
Massimo, if you have an explanation of why in the case of the fermions you don't observe the dynamical instability in a so clear way as you do with BEC?
For the BEC we use, we explain, or at least the theoretician, they explain the occurrence of the dynamical instability because we use the Gross-Pitayevsky, which is a nonlinear equation, and so on. In the case of the fermions, it is simply the single particle physics of a fermion going, up and down. So it's not the physics which is there is not described by an equation, a nonlinear equation like the Gross-Pitayevsky, and so on. And they are all identical. This is an idea.
All identical.
Of course, yes. Also the interferometry and everything was identical. Otherwise, they.
So thank you very much for the questions. I think we should get to the topic first.